Welcome to the American Reformer Podcast, hosted by Josh Abatoy and Timon Klein. Our mission is to promote a vigorous Christian approach to the cultural challenges of our day, rooted in the rich tradition of Protestant social and political thought.
Okay, welcome back to the American Reformer Podcast. One of your usual hosts here, Timon Klein, Editor-in-Chief. Joined today by Terry Gant, our Managing Editor. Josh Abatoy, our Director, is on the road, so he's could not join us today. So me and Terry will have to carry on, but we're of course joined by a special guest, Raymond Ibrahim. We've been wanting to have Raymond on the show for a while because his, especially in our circles with a lot of our readers, his new book, Defenders of the West, has been a source of a lot of excitement and enthusiasm. People are loving it. Terry wrote an excellent review of the book for us, so everyone can go check that out, and we'll put it in the show notes as well. But Raymond, thanks so much for joining us, and tell us a little bit about, for the audience that doesn't know you, it's not aware of the book yet, a little bit about your background and your interest and how you got to doing what you're doing now.
Sure, Timon. So my interest is both, as I often say, personal and professional. Personally, my family is from Egypt, Coptic Christians, if you're familiar with that, basically the most indigenous inhabitants of Egypt before it was conquered by Islam. I was born here in the United States, but I grew up hearing stories about all sorts of things, but including the persecution that Christians were experiencing past and present as well. So I grew up with that. I grew up bilingual. I also spoke colloquial Arabic, which I studied later formally in college. And then in college, I got my bachelor's and master's in history, and with an emphasis on the medieval era as well as the classical era, Greek, Roman, and the ancient era, Egypt, Mesopotamia, etc. My professor, as many people. He's pretty popular now, not so much back then. We're talking 25 years ago. It was Victor Davis Hanson. And so he was the chair of my master's thesis as well. And that thesis, which I wrote before 2000, I believe, dealt with the first battle between Muslims and Christians, the Battle of Yarmouk in the year 636. And so I made use of the languages I was studying, Arabic, classical Greek, as well as others. So I've been obviously involved in this, both, like I said, academically and personally. And then I also went to Georgetown University soon after the strikes of 9/11. I was in the Center of Contemporary Arab Studies for about a year, though I left because that's when I learned all about political correctness in academia, et cetera, et cetera. And then I went to the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and I worked there as a linguistic specialist with various Near Eastern languages. And I found writings by Al-Qaeda that had never been translated. And long story short, that became my first book, which was published in 2007, The Al-Qaeda Reader, whereby I basically translated their internal writings and essentially showed how they were lying, because their communiques to the West were always about reciprocal treatment. We're attacking you because you attacked us, because of Israel, because of everything. But they're in their own writings, it was sounded more like ISIS. You know, it was just pure jihad. There are enemies no matter what, Americans, et cetera. So that became my first book. Then my second book, The Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians, went back to my older interests about the Muslim persecution of Christians, which very few people know about or how bad it is. And I've continued with that. Every month I still write a report since 2011, where I collate all of the instances of persecution that surface or are documented every month. So that's been going on for about 13 years, and it's maybe like 100,000 or 500,000 words last time I checked of documentation of nonstop persecution. And then more recently, I started with going back to my original interest in history, my academic interest. And I wrote Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. That came out in 2018. And it was very successful that I was actually encouraged to write a similar book, which I did. And that's the one we're talking about, Defenders of the West, which, both books really complement each other. Sword and Scimitar looks at decisive battles between Islam and the West. Defenders of the West looks at decisive men who fought and stood up for the West against Islam. And I've been involved professionally with various think tanks. I've been at the Hoover Institution. I'm at the Middle East Forum, Gatestone Institute, other places as well, temporarily. And so that's what I do. I read, I research, and I write about the topic mostly of the nexus between Islam and Western civilization, both historically and in the present. And I always like documenting the continuity between the two, because I think that itself is very telling.
Yes, well, something you said earlier, you know, when you were still in, you know, academia yourself, studying, you know, recognizing even at that kind of early date, at least in this field, many other fields too, that, you know, the environment for real kind of history was becoming stifling because of, you know, political correctness, as we used to call it. I guess we'd call it woke now, you know, post-colonial studies, all this stuff. This book in particular is decidedly not politically correct. And maybe it wouldn't have been able to be been written in that environment. And you correct, you know, throughout the book, at least on my reading, you correct at least colloquial narratives about many of the figures, including, you know, my favorite is Vlad Dracula. Personally, I'm a Impaler respecter, not the practice, the guy. I loved it both. And you cover a couple guys in Wallachia those were my favorite chapters, but in, you know, embedded in all this and in most of your work is the war, the perpetual wars, it seems, between Christianity and Islam. And, you know, one thing that strikes me is with Christians, we tend to emphasize in sort of our formative narrative, the persecution of the Romans, right? Very early, which was sporadic and concentrated in particular emperors, ebbed and flowed. I think Peter Lighthart deals very well with this in the Defending Constantine, but we rarely emphasize this aspect, right? The Islamic persecution of Christians. It just doesn't seem to live in our consciousness anymore in the same way, but it did for these men. Why do you think that's been, has it been intentionally forgotten and sanitized because of other interests, or are we just bad at our own history?
No, it's very much, well, it's a little bit both, but it begins with an intentional sanitizing. And then, of course, you get bad historians because they don't know any better and they don't know they've been indoctrinated or, you know, hoodwinked, as it were. And they perpetuate the sort of whitewashed narrative, thinking that's what it is. The reality is Christians today are suffering much more persecution than under the Roman era. And, you know, that's the problem with Western Christianity. Christians, they're unfortunately in something of a bubble, and they think Christians are here in America and it's okay. You know, the worst problems that Christians in America experience are some sort of legal problems over baking a cake or something to that effect. In reality, all around the world, There's a humanitarian organization called Open Doors, which documents persecution of Christians. And every year they publish a report. And it's habitually, I think, the most recent one, it's something like 380 million Christians are being persecuted. It's a lot more than under Rome. And they rank the top 50 worst persecuting nations. And habitually, because I really closely look at this every year for many years now, something like, I don't know, because I count them, something like 25 to 35 of the top 50 worst nations are Muslim nations. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's really the bulk of it. Mm-hmm. And when you delve in and you really look at it, the persecution that the Christians experience in these Muslim nations, I mean, it's just commonsensical because the religion itself prescribes persecution of Christians and others. And historically, they were persecuted. So, you know, the Quran itself, 9:29, says, fight the people of the book, which means Christians and Jews, until they pay tribute and feel themselves subdued. And then there's a whole elaborate exposition on what all that means. So they can't build churches. Long story short, they're second-class citizens. And their rights, you know, depend on the will of the Muslims. And that's both in the past and in the present. And so there's definitely been a lot of whitewashing. I'll give you just one big example from history. One caliph, a Fatimid caliph in Egypt, Hakim bin Amr Allah is his name. He, under his reign, he destroyed, according to Muslim sources, and even I find this number, you know, just too hard to wrap my head around, but 30,000 churches in Egypt and greater Syria. And the number itself isn't shocking because those regions were so heavily Christian, technically more than the West at that time, that point in time, that they did have that. John Cassian talks about going up and down Egypt and all you hear is hymns and church singing, et cetera, et cetera. So that there were that many makes sense. But he destroyed all or transformed them into mosques, and he raised the Holy Sepulchre, which is what the Crusades were all about, which is the church that was built by Constantine over the site of Christ's burial and resurrection. But today, when you hear about it, he's always dismissed as the mad caliph because what he did is supposedly such an aberration. And, you know, it's in no way, shape or form reflective of Islam. That's not the case. And if you really delve into it, he was doing it to satisfy the Muslim Sunni population because he was a Shia and he wanted to show he's a good Muslim. Being a good Muslim is therefore persecuting Christians, etc. That's just one example, but and you can see it in both the books that I've written, in Sword and Scimitar and Defenders of the West, I touch on the persecution of the Christians, the local indigenous groups, and how that often provoked the Crusades, as you were saying. And, you know, right before – so I guess the best way to do this is give you a quick summary, historical summary, hopefully in like three or four minutes.
No, I was going
to
ask for that anyway. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So in the 7th century, Islam is born. And Christianity has been entrenched now in the Near East and Europe, in the Roman Empire, essentially, for centuries. And like I said, countries like Egypt and Syria and what we call Turkey, Asia Minor, Anatolia, were really the older, richer, more populous, and more theologically sophisticated Christian centers. You know, five of the Holy Sees or centers, four of them were in the East. You had Rome in the West, and then later Constantinople, but the three main ones, Antioch, Alexandria, and Jerusalem, obviously were in the East. So in the 7th century, Islam barges onto the scene, and long story short, Muhammad dies in 632, and by 732, one century later, Muslims had conquered everything from the Near East, which is greater Syria, encompassing all the modern territories, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, and then all of North Africa from Egypt to Morocco. They had now conquered Spain, which they entered in 711. And 732, I mentioned that date because that's where they're finally halted at Tours, the Battle of Tours, which is essentially in the middle of France. So in one century, all that region, which is all Christian, was completely conquered and Islamized. And then if you look at the sources, the persecution that the Christians, which were, of course, the overwhelming majority of that region, experienced is more or less like what we saw under ISIS, and we were told is not Islamic and doesn't represent Islam, etc. No, it was just like that. So, you know, mass enslavements, concubinage of women, burning the churches, turning them into mosques, exacting tribute from the Christians, they had to live as second-class citizens, etc., etc. So that's all throughout the sources. And then right before the Crusades, a new manifestation of this Islamic jihad became the Turks. They became the standard bearers, essentially, of jihad. Before them, it's the Arabs. And now in the 11th century, again, the sources just talk about mass destruction and atrocities in Asia Minor, especially against the Armenians. Now, we hear about the Turkish genocide of the Armenians in the 19th century, early 20th century. It actually goes back to the 11th century, 1,000 years earlier. And those sources, again, they talk about tens of thousands of Christians, Armenians, and also Greeks in the western portion of Asia Minor, just being slaughtered. Again, tens of thousands being enslaved. One city, Ani, which was the capital, I think, at the time of Armenia, was known as the church, city of 1,000 churches. All the churches were burned and torched. And that is really what led to the Crusades, because a few years after that, the emperor, the Eastern Roman Emperor, or Byzantine Emperor, Alexius, contacted some of his friends and colleagues in Western Europe, including the Pope, and asked for aid. And that's what Pope Urban II mentioned at the Council of Clermont in 1095, which is what was happening to Christians, as well as Western European pilgrims to the Holy Land, who had always been, you know, abused, but now had reached a whole new level. And again, I have lots of documentation of what they would put them through, the pilgrims. So that's the First Crusade. And now, you know, so move to now, and you mention the Crusades to anyone, or even if you say, hey, why is there, what's the historical background of the conflict between Europe and Islam, and invariably you're going to be told it's the Crusades in a vacuum, as if they just came out of nowhere and there's no backdrop, no context, and the Muslims didn't do all the things that I just described. In fact, some historians flat out say that. John Esposito of Georgetown University, where I went, and I'll give any more of an indication why I stopped going there, he wrote something to paraphrase that 4 centuries of peace elapsed between Islam and Europe until a papal power play led to, you know, the Crusades and mistrust and hostility since then, which is, of course, absurd because the Crusades happened in response to 4 centuries of abuses, actually, that had reached a fever pitch right before the first Crusade. So that gives you an idea of what happened historically and what we're being told happened, which is that nothing happened. And it all starts 4 centuries later when the Christians finally move into Islamic held lands, which, you know, just the logistical movement alone makes it look worse, because now, you know, why are Europeans leaving Europe and going into the Middle East? They're the attackers. They're the invaders. At least that's how it looks until you understand the backdrop and the context of it.
Yeah, we are just inundated with those, you know, revisionist, the first round of revision. Now you're providing a corrective, you know, narrative on much of this, but the first revisionist narratives, you know, it's pretty much everywhere apart from a few, you know, important books over the years. You know, I think maybe it was Rodney Stark did a decent job trying to rehabilitate a proper narrative. But, you see something like, you know, Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven or something like this. It very much presents that kind of narrative, which is, you know, terrible because it, aesthetically and everything else, it's a great movie. And it's a missed chance to, you know, present a true narrative and a sort of heroic one. But I think that is what you do in your book. And you, part of, I think the reason it's been popular, especially young amongst, you know, Christian young men, is because it presents these guys, you know, I think, in an honest way, but as heroes. And people want, you know, heroes to emulate and to recognize that there's a way that both true piety, you know, assuming we take them earnestly, which I see no reason not to, despite, you know, modern kind of assumptions, but piety and a sort of martial spirit, and a love for your people, or, you know, these are all congruent things. And so, you know, and all of them kind of emulate that in their own way. But we can get into, you know, a few of them. I'm sure Terry wants to jump in here, you know, in writing his review. I don't know, Terry, if you had a favorite of the characters. I've already listed mine, which is the last one. Again, although both the Wallachians were inspiring to me, as well as the you know, the Albanian William Wallace. That's a cool story. But Terry, go ahead and hop in there with some as we get into the book.
Well, my favorite, it's tough. It's a tough choice because, and I think I've heard another interview with you, Raymond, where you were asked that question yourself, and we're kind of like, well, I just like them all. That's why they were in the book. And that's kind of how I feel about them. I think if I had to pick one, it would probably be Godfrey. And I alluded to this in my review, but I legitimately teared up at the part where he said, why, how am I going to wear a crown of gold in the city where my savior wore a crown of thorns? And I just don't, it's just really emboldening to a Christian to hear that there are Christian heroes that are legitimately Christians. They aren't merely Christians in name only, or some kind of, I'm not sure if he and I would be fully aligned on all doctrines, but this is a man who was truly in pursuit of personal piety and was a legitimately dangerous guy in physical martial terms. If I had to pick a second one, it would be Skanderbeg, just because his story is just so, just turning the Janissary against them is such a great way that his story flows. But I'm curious, are there any guys that didn't make the cut? Was there like a B team that you're withholding for a second book, or are there guys that were almost in and just didn't quite make it because you didn't have space, or what was that? What's going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I even, you know, because I knew this is a good question, I think I discussed it some length in the introduction. One of my criteria was because there was some overlap between this book, Defenders of the West, and the previous book, Sword and Scimitar. I decided that the men that I mentioned in Sword and Scimitar, some of who could easily fit in into Defenders of the West, to leave them out because I already gave them some time, and I wanted to not just kind of, you know, recycle, you know, from my older book. And some of those men would be the Byzantine Emperor Nicephorus or Nikephorus II, Phocas, and of course the you know, the Battle of Lepanto. I can't believe I'm forgetting his name right now. Prince John, the half brother of King Emperor Charles. I put a lot of names in the introduction. So if you have the book and look in the introduction, I mention a bunch of names that I thought about and considered, but because I already mentioned it in the context of the first book, I just left them out so I can make room for newer stories, so I'm not redundant. So that was one thing. The other thing, of course, is space. You know, this could be volumes. You'll be happy to know, since I understand you like the idea of heroic Christians, that there were, you know, there's no end to them. There's many. You could have volumes. So definitely space constraints was one dictating force. And unfortunately, because there was so much information, I was going to put, I think, originally like 12 heroes, but each chapter got so long. The book as it is much longer than the publisher wanted it, and that was a headache. So, space constraints and not wanting to be redundant played a big role in who I ended up choosing.
I think that begs the question of, and I don't know if you can divulge this, I don't know if there's secrecy with these kinds of deals, but will there be a subsequent volume with more guys in it? Is the publisher interested? Has it been successful enough that they want one?
Yes, I'm currently working on a new book that is going to complement these books, but I won't divulge too much. But it's going to be very similar in the same essence of Sword and Scimitar and Defenders of the West. Mm. And I actually just started, so it might be a little bit before it comes out. Mm. That's why I don't want to talk too much about it.
Excellent. Piggybacking off of that, I mean, I know that this is your area of focus, Raymond. And even in terms of periodization, but you know, as you've already expressed, I mean, this sort of conflict between Western Christianity, well, Eastern and Western Christianity, of course, and Islam, you know, is perpetual. You end with, you know, with Vlad and you know, just prior in a sense to the emergence of Protestantism and the Reformation, and these things, you know, continue. I mean, a lot of Luther's motivation for kind of his we would say his militant reform of the German church is the Ottomans are still on the doorstep. You know, he's worried about this, and he sees it in eschatological terms. Have you thought about, you know, covering further ground that direction as well, or is that something, you know, you're kind of sticking in what we
call the Protestant Holy War?
Well, into the early modern period, as we'd call it now, you know, for terms.
Well, I do somewhat cover that in Sword and Scimitar because that goes all the way up until, you know, the Barbary Wars in America. Mm-hmm. And I talk a little bit about the modern era, 21st century, not a whole lot. You know, it's still there, but it's not the same essence. Mm-hmm. The West has this, two things happen at the same time. The West becomes secular and then it has this meteoric rise in power and strength and influence. And so the conflict with Islam becomes really, it takes on a different format. You know, we have colonialism, for example, where now the West is going in and, the white man's burden civilizing. And it's completely different paradigm. It's very interesting and fascinating. And I may, in fact, there is talking about, because of the interest in these historical books, I'm mostly focused on this, but one of the book ideas that I was supposed to be looking into is the modern era, the colonial era, what it really signified, because there's a lot of, again, there's a lot of misrepresentation about what colonialism really was. It's like everything else now, presented as, you know, racist white supremacists coming and abusing peaceful brown people. You know, but there's a lot more to it than that, mm-hmm. and a lot more to it that's connected to what we're discussing. It's definitely an interesting topic, and I may at one point, mm-hmm. once I exhaust these, the more heroic and historic aspects, early historic aspects.
Mm. Yeah. And as you know, I mean, I just point out to people too, the, you know, the, The slave markets continue, but it's through Arabs, not Christians at this point. I mean, I grew up.
Another book that's on my list is Islamic Slavery, because that's another thing that people know about, and again, would help offer a corrective to the narrative that, you know, slavery somehow begins and ends with white people.
Yeah. When I spent some of my childhood, my parents were missionaries in Senegal, West Africa, and the you know, for all the tree huggers out there, the pure amount of environmental destruction brought by the Arabs to that area too. I mean, the Sahara Desert grows like 2 miles a year because of all the logging, you know, at a radical rate that the Muslims did, and of course introduced slave markets that continue even today. You can go effectively see them. So it is, you know, all that swirling around. But instead of pushing you on what you haven't written yet, you just got done with this one. So we'll get back to the book at hand. Yeah. We already, you know, asked about the favorites. You know, some of these, you know, the Cid, people are going to know Charlton Heston and you know, some of these tales a bit, you know, something about them. But which one have you found, which figure have you found people knew the least about and was the most kind of left field to them out of the eight chapters?
Well, I think to most people, they don't know anything about any of these characters. Hmm. But what's worse is what they think they know. And so I think, for example, a lot of people think they know about Dracula or Vlad the Impaler. Mm-hmm. But when you read the real history, it's, you know, it's completely different. Yeah, I mean, there's, of course, elements of violence and sadism, if you will. But, you know, again, the context is sadism was everywhere at the time. Mm-hmm. And but once again, you know, one guy's lifted up and the spotlight's on him. And we don't talk about the sadism of the Ottomans, for example, mm-hmm. and the cruelty and the atrocities and the impalement, etc. So I think I think in the book I talk a little bit about what people know, and mostly the Balkanites, as I call them, mm-hmm. Skanderbeg and John Hunyadi and Vlad are the ones that, you know, either people don't know them at all. Skanderbeg is essentially was really the most heroic and famous all throughout Europe, you know, more than all the other characters, really. For his feats of prowess. And anyone, of course, who reads the book will know why, because it's a very remarkable tale. But how many people in America even have ever heard of George Castriotti, Skanderbeg? Mm-hmm. Same thing with John Hunyadi. So these Balkan, Eastern European types are completely out of the Western consciousness. And then the ones who are more Western, some people think they know a little bit about, but they don't. So King Richard, El Cid, Rodrigo or Roderick, Diaz, as his real name is, both of them are always represented in a cavalier, sort of arrogant. And King Richard definitely had a little bit of that, but we're not made privy to his battles with Islam, his piety, which he definitely had more than how he's always represented, and you know, the self-sacrifice that he engaged in during those wars. Same thing with Cid, you know, even if going all the way back to the Charlton Heston movie made in the 60s, I think, you know, it's much less politically correct than anything that will come out today, obviously, which is good. But it still highlights the sort of, you know, oh, Muslims and Christians were great friends. And, you know, the El Cid was, he wasn't really fighting for Christianity, and the Christians were just as bad as the Muslims, et cetera, et cetera. So, but if you look at the sources, as I do in the book, it's not quite like that. You know, there is a civilizational divide and loyalties and, you know, constant warfare whenever it's advantageous to one side or the other. So I think all in all, a lot of people will be surprised. And that's the comments I get from people. It's just, you know, oh, I thought I knew about this guy, but wow, I don't remember hearing any of this about him. Or, you know, who's this guy? I never heard of him, like Skanderbeg. What a story. I mean, think honestly, any one of these chapters, can't they make a blockbuster movie? And you wouldn't even have to exaggerate or lie the way Hollywood does by making things up out of thin air. These are actual stories that are documented from primary sources, and they're just amazingly heroic, but they'll never touch them precisely because of that. Going back to something else that was said, I think one of the things that, you know, the system that exists, which we call the left, though I don't care for that word, which is inherently anti-Christian, one of the things it most fears is having Christians think that their heritage and their legacy does involve heroism. And that's why I think everything's done to suppress these characters and to make Christians always think that they're doormats, okay? That Jesus was all about just turning the other cheek, not judging, unconditional love, and just being passive, which anyone who's read the New Testament knows that's not the case, obviously. Mm-hmm. And we saw this actually during the Super Bowl, for those who watched. Mm. One commercial especially highlighted this. It's called Washing Feet. And, you know, if you see it, it's just a bunch of images of people washing other people's feet. And then in the end, it says, Jesus didn't teach hate. You know, he washed feet. And then the images that they show, of course, are all politically charged. Mm-hmm. One is and all the people washing feet are white, probably traditional Christians. And the people whose feet are being washed are, you know, one is obviously a migrant, who probably an illegal immigrant who came into America. One is a clergyman's washing the foot of a transgender person. And one is a woman washing the foot of a Muslim in a hijab. So the idea is, you know, the good Christian never criticizes, never questions, just accepts. One, it was a woman who is at an abortion clinic. The bad Christians are protesting, but the good woman is washing the foot mm-hmm. of the woman who just had an abortion. Okay, so the message is clear. A true Christian just acquiesces and is passive and just never does anything except submits. Well, that's not Christian. Try telling that to the characters and defenders of the West. That's not the Christianity they know or are familiar with. And the one they know is much older than ours. What we know is actually relatively new. And I think it's created by design by people who are inherently hostile to Christianity. Because what better way, what better message could you have if you hate Christians? What's the best thing to do? Wouldn't you love it if you convince them their whole purpose in life is to be a doormat and to accept anything you want to do and to just submit and help you? Obviously, that's a great thing for anyone who hates Christians. Mm-hmm. So I believe that has really been that idea has been so propped up, pulled out of context. This isn't to say that Christianity has no mercy, love, and forgiveness, but it's very much balanced because the same person who preached all that, Jesus, also flipped tables around and whipped people. And the idea of just war, which goes back, of course, to the New Testament and all the early church fathers agreed to it, is there. Whereas today, you know, so many Christians think they can never do anything physical or violent. Mm. And it's just, it's really preposterous when you think of it. It's easier said than done. Mm. When you live here in the West and you're safe, you can say that. But if you have people breaking down your door and trying to abduct and rape your children and wife, are you going to stand there and say, well, Jesus said not to do anything? Mm. I mean, do you honestly think that's what Jesus would want? It's just amazing. Yeah. But I think people have been so conditioned into that. Which has really led to the weakening overall of Christianity, making it very passive. And they've been divorced from the earlier manifestation, the more muscular version of Christianity. And that's, again, by design, because the last thing that the left, as it's called, wants is to have Christians reclaim that sort of heritage. I think they find that probably the most dangerous thing that could ever happen. So short of turning people away from Christianity, the next best thing is to convince them Christianity is all about you doing nothing but turning the other cheek.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's the spot on. I mean, there's so much there. The you know, that He Gets Us campaign. That's what I was trying to remember the name of that Super Bowl commercial. You know, the entire part of the message there is that, you know, Christianity has no, not just no martial spirit, but no cultural expansionism or conditioning that it produces. You know, it's just the acceptance of everything the way it is, and there's no change. I mean, that's the washing of the feet. When the entire civilization is, as you're getting at, that allows you to even produce such a ridiculous commercial is produced by the type of people in this book, right? That fought for this in a, as you're pointing out, largely defensive posture because of the atrocities being committed against innocent people of their faith. And so protecting women and children and weaker people is somehow not a Christ-like virtue. I'm not sure where that's coming from in people today. Of course, what offends many people, I'm sure, because masculinity is, you know, so toxic now or whatever, even though we have less of it than ever. I don't know why it's all of a sudden extremely toxic. You know, it's a certain level of ambition and drive for achievement and conquest and these you know, masculine kind of impulses that can be good, rightly channeled to something like these men were pursuing. But that you're right, that's completely threatening. So the best thing to do is to neuter it. There's no cultural impact. You must accept everything the way, you know, we tell you it is, even as we're perfectly fine administering violence all over the world for a different gospel. That's okay to do, but just not for, you know, the true gospel. That would be crazy. But in the book, I mean, something along these lines, I think I was going to say implicit. It's not quite implicit, but it's there. It's explicit as well. Is you know, violence or hostility and conflict. I mean, these are just staples of the day. To point out that the period of the Crusades was violent and therefore bad is like pointing out the sky is blue and therefore the day is bad. You know, it's just something that's there. So it's a much more in this way, it's more formative of you know, resilience, masculinity, all these things because of the conditions, but it's just the world as it was. I mean, we're blessed to not have to deal with that on a daily basis for sure, but it's just part of the day. So that other men, you know, men in response to violence were also violent is a really weird critique, but that's pretty much where it all lands. And that's good enough for everyone today, which just, again, shows how effeminate and weak kind of our culture is. But, you know, what in this sense, because it's not like violence is gone, you know, how do we reorient Christians towards, you know, maybe it's through stories, aspirational stories, how do we reorient them towards the reality, essentially, that this hasn't gone away? It's just sort of repackaged and smoothed over, and you're told not to notice. But the same conflicts are still there. And Muslims certainly see it as waging a war on Christianity, even if we're apostatizing by the day.
Yeah, and that's the whole point. You know, there's a lot of deception and misrepresentation, and it's all done to tailor a sort of worldview for us to accept and believe, which is, you know, I mean, that violence is an aberration. And if anyone is, it's historically been Europeans and Christians, et cetera. I mean, look at it. When it comes to history, it's just amazing how for the slavery issue, you know, to most people today, if you mention slavery, all they believe that ever happened was whites enslaved blacks and everyone else who's non-white. And when you really look at the numbers and who everyone enslaved everyone, and what the Muslims and the Arabs did to the sub-Saharan Africans is so much worse than the European transatlantic slave trade. But you don't hear about that. So it's the reason is, and it's in the book, it's the same paradigm everywhere I look, which is, everyone does the same bad things, except everyone does it more than Christians. And then when the Christians do something, what we're told is what the Christians did, that is blown out of proportion. And then what everyone else did doesn't even exist. And that's the story of the Crusades. So really, the Crusades are a drop of in the bucket of the violence between and wars between Muslims and Christians. And most of it was coming from Muslims attacking Christians. But if you talk about historic warfare between Muslims and Christians, everyone will talk about the Crusades. As if that's it. That's what it was. Same thing with the slavery. So I think everything from education to academia and Hollywood and politicians, everything that the message, right, is that, you know, Western Europe historically is the bad guy because of Christianity. And now the good Christians, if you want to be Christians, are the doormats who do nothing and just accept what we tell them, basically. And that kind of message, I think, permeates everything now, including the theology. And that's probably the worst part of so many Christians in the West, that they think that is the truth. And that's the danger of it, because there is truth in that. Like I said, you know, there is mercy and forgiveness and love and tolerance, but it's very much balanced. And so, you know, they've taken one part, and that's what a heresy technically is. You take one part and blow it out of proportion, and then you ignore the rest. So I think Christians need to wake up to that and realize that most of the form of Christianity that a lot of them are embracing today has no historical parallel. And I don't even mean the whole, you know, obviously the Reformation changed so much. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the more or less cultural aspects. You know, this idea of, you know, Protestants themselves were not in early Protestants. A lot of them believed in holy war, believe it or not. So this isn't something that, oh, in the Reformation, we decided holy war is a bad thing. No, that was still an aspect that was subscribed to by, you know, during the Battle of Lepanto, for example, in 1671, you know, Protestants were celebrating after the Catholics beat the Ottomans. So I think people just need to come back to the reality that, you know, to be a Christianity, Christ never was teaching us to be doormats. Okay. You know, what's the first thing that Jesus did when he would perform a miracle? After the miracle, he would counsel the recipient to what? Go and sin no more, or go repent. Right. Mm-hmm. But there's one instance where a pagan Roman emperor, the centurion, asks, he gets his servant healed. And all that Jesus says is how great the faith of the centurion is. He doesn't tell him, go now and quit the Roman army because you're killing people. Mm-hmm. So even for Jesus, it was understood that that sort of, you know, organized state, you know, force was an acceptable part of society and civilization. Otherwise, he would have told him that. John the Baptist had the same incident when soldiers came and asked him, and he said, what should we do to be saved? And he told them, be content with your wages as soldiers. He didn't tell them, leave the army. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot there that people just intentionally have been told isn't there. And all that is there is, you know, just the love and the mercy and the forgiveness and the tolerance and the turning the other cheek. And it needs to be balanced with, you know, a little bit of righteous indignation. And that's what the men that we just were discussing had. And that's what existed for centuries and centuries. Whereas, like I said, what we have right now is quite the aberration, which hasn't existed for very long, because even the early Protestants didn't think this way.
Yeah. Yeah. To give the audience one example, and they're probably tired of me mentioning Richard Baxter, but I love him so much, you know, late 17th century writing, and his whole theory, he's talking about, you know, a sort of coalition, international coalition potentially of just Protestant nations. And he says, what we should do is to, you know, in the Americas, we should send our missionaries. And then if the populace is resistant and tries to kill them, then we're going to have to go wage holy war and take them over. You know, so that's like the thing. There's like evangelism, of course. And if they convert, great. But if they start, it won't let us preach the gospel. There's only one recourse. You know, you're going to have to go because they need this. This is good for them. So that kind of attitude, I mean, it's, you know, that's, Baxter's already writing at the beginning of the so-called Enlightenment, you know, where supposedly we got away from all these nasty opinions. So it's certainly true. It's just a perennial attitude of all, you know, serious Christians, seemingly up till yesterday, even into the founding era. But Terry, I've been talking for a while. Hop back in here. I don't want to dominate too much here.
Sure. I would just ask, Raymond, do you consider the kind of changing the narrative on this and communicating the truth about the Christian historical perspective on just war and holy war? Is that kind of a part of a personal mission for you?
Yeah, you could put it that way. I never thought of it that way, but I've definitely in recent times and years have written a lot, researched a lot, and you know, we were talking about my forthcoming books. One might actually be dedicated to the idea of just warfare and how it manifested itself historically and how it needs to be resuscitated in a legitimate way, not just willy-nilly, obviously. I really think that those who dislike and seek to destroy and harm and overthrow Christianity have learned to worm their way inside it and essentially just pull out a whole different message. So like I said, if you can't destroy it, well, make it subservient to you and make it, you know, that's even better, actually. You know, so that's why there's been this concerted campaign, I think, just from everywhere. And like I said, you know, those who originate it and push it and possibly fund it know what they're doing. But then the mass of nominal Christians at least believe it. So in this sense, they take on a false theology thinking that's the truth. And then they perpetuate it. But I think we're seeing the harms of it today where, you know, Christianity, and this is why Christianity has become so effete and just, you know, weak. I was watching, what's his name, Andrew Tate, just because he popped up on a YouTube thing, and I didn't even realize this, but I guess he's Muslim. Mm-hmm. But he was saying, I'm Muslim because, you know what, Islam stands for its beliefs, whereas Christians just are, you know, well, whatever, you know, do whatever you want, everything's fine. Mm-hmm. And well, he's right about that, but I would argue he's wrong, and that is not true Christianity. But that is what so many Western Christians especially think it is. So that sort of thinking definitely needs to be revised and updated and brought back to something more sensible, which, like I said, historically it was. Nobody at all had any qualms with the idea of just war. And for the reason that I told you, if you really break it down, you got someone breaking into your house, trying to murder, kill, and rape, right? And you can stop them through force. I just can't imagine Jesus is saying, no, don't do that. Mm. You know, you sit there and watch your wife and children get raped and mauled. Okay. So, you know, when you break it down to that sort of basic element, then obviously, yes, there is room for standing up even with violence. And that's why, you know, earlier Christians, including in America and in Europe, had no problem with things like execution, mm-hmm. or going to war, because they understood that. But today, the prevalent message is you want to be a Christian, then you have to be a woman, essentially. Mm. And I think this move goes hand in hand with this sort of trans business and, you know, effeminizing men. Mm-hmm. Okay, because the powers that be, if you want to control society, would you rather control a society of women or men? Obviously, mm-hmm. it's going to be a lot easier to control a society of women, even if they're men who think they're women and act mm-hmm. like women. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Christianity. Would you rather control a society of Christians who are bold believers and stand up for the truth, even if it means through warfare? Or would you rather Christians who think they're doormats? Mm-hmm. So I think that's really what's been going on, and it's been happening for generations, and it just keeps getting worse and worse.
Yeah. Yeah, it struck me too when I was reading, you know, the you know, King Philip's War in America in the late 17th century, which was, you know, is considered by historians to be very formative for kind of the New England people, even leading up through the founding, was more, there were more casualties per capita than World War II or the Civil War. You know, it was just absolutely brutal. But it's amazing to read, you know, accounts at the time, either being sent over, you know, back to London or just in the colonies. You know, they see all of this in starkly spiritual terms. You know, this is a demonic force that's coming in, and they're brutal, and they're burning our towns and all this. And it strikes me that we're almost incapable of having that spiritual frame to interpret things that are happening, you know, these realities, they're invisible, but our enemies, civilizationally speaking, you know, do see it that way. I mean, their eschatology drives everything they're doing, and it's hard for us to, part of the reason I think we've been so inept in responding to it, even where we absolutely need to, is because we can't get in this medieval mindset that our adversaries still, you know, function under. And that's why they're very aggressive and effective at colonizing, you know, European cities and American cities at this point. And we seem to just be completely incapable of responding in kind. And maybe it's because we lack all sufficient piety and spiritual frame that a lot of these guys, you know, like a Gottfried would have.
Yeah, anyone who's been educated in American public school systems obviously knows that anything medieval is always like looked down upon. It's just unenlightened. It's barbaric. It's dark. Yeah. Is that the case, or is that once again fake news because they want to turn us away from their medieval type of civilization, medieval type thinking? Mm-hmm. You know, it's reached the point wherever, you know, the powers that be, if they say something's bad, you want to look twice because that's probably a good thing. And if they say it's good, you definitely want to look twice because it's probably a bad thing.
Yes.
I mean, I the whole idea of the Enlightenment and the narrative that we're given, you know, crazy, barbaric, medieval Christians, and then all of a sudden they become secular and wise and smart. I believe that's a lot of bunk, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And a lot of real, you know, professional historians who focus on that topic have said the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's you know, there, as usual, there may be elements of truth, but then it's blown out of proportion and it's used exclusively to, again, make Christianity or strong Christianity civilization, such as the medieval era, look like it's horrible time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being freed and unshackled of it brought wonders and, you know, greatness. When in reality, of course, all the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment thinkers, a lot of them were Christian, the initial ones. So then that, of course, again, is suppressed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think we've been, you know, the idea of fake news, which has become really popular in a few years, I think it's we've had fake history, we have fake academia, and all of it works in concert in many ways in the topic that we're discussing, which is to divorce modern men and women, especially Christians, from their heritage. and just, you know, convince them in secularism and materialistic type thinking. And, you know, heroism doesn't exist. It's, mm-hmm. it's just in movies, you know, everyone is cynical. You see that always in movies. And cynicism always reigns as if there's never been a sincere self-sacrifice, mm-hmm. act of self-sacrifice. But you'll see it, of course, in the book all throughout. Mm-hmm. So that always existed. So they don't want us to believe that happens. So we don't become like that. And we are just materialists and hedonists who just, you know, think about, you know, the self, which is what's leading. Look at Europe. It's become it's a complete joke. It's taken over, most of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I learned recently that London, the capital of merry old England, is maybe 35% white, you know, and the rest, and, you know, they got mosques blaring the Shahada, the, you know, Mohammedan creeds and women everywhere. And it's a takeover. I mean, and what other civilization has been so weakened that they just give up and give their greatest cities away? Where else do you see that? That's never happened. Mm-hmm. And that's just a reflection of just how enervated and emasculated, you know, mm-hmm. Western civilization has become.
Yeah. And even when there's a chance, you know, for the secularist to, you know, you think, well, maybe, you know, this sort of great man theory of history, which they, of course, castigate. And there's, you know, there's an opportunity for them to do it kind of without Christianity, like I'm thinking of the Napoleon movie. And then you watch it, and it's just a total flop. You know, it's all about him being, it's about the feminine influence, and that's driving everything. There's no real ambition or drive or genius to him. They just totally, you know, flatten the character. It becomes totally uninteresting and inhuman, really. And it's like no one could have done what Napoleon did on this basis, you know, as Joaquin Phoenix. It just wouldn't have happened. Yeah. And so it's you know, it's like even if you took the religion out of it, which is the key point for most of what we're talking about, they still don't want to do it, you know, not even on a secular religious basis, we could say. So it's just wild. And then you wonder why is, you know, you have a Angela Merkel, you know, just welcoming in, saying it's awesome that Berlin is essentially going to be Muslim or already is. I'm not sure. And it's just complete suicide. I think you're right. I mean, I would love to hear another narrative of this kind of suicide by a civilization. But I usually you go
it's never happened.
Is a glory. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is much preferable.
I mean, you know, I've said this before because, you know, these statistics I recently encountered, but, you know, the white population of the world is, I think, like 4% maybe. Mm-hmm. And so they're, you know, it's a tiny minority. And yet everywhere you look, it's white lands and white civilization, white culture that has to give in mm-hmm. and is deemed immoral if they don't, to more and more non-whites taking over their land.
Yeah.
And people don't, you know, whites in Europe and America don't see that because they're still the majority. Mm. So it doesn't seem that bad. But, you know, America and Europe and Canada, Australia, that's a drop in the bucket mm. as far as the mass of humanity. Mm. So it's just amazing that, you know, everyone else, you know, I saw this Scottish prime minister, I think he's like Pakistani, mm-hmm. and he's up there complaining because most posts in the Scottish government are white people. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know, he mentions a particular position, white, another position, white. Well, you know, Scotland's like 98% white. would anyone think of doing that? Would you go to Saudi Arabia and complain and say, you know, the king is Saudi? And, the, you know, no one would ever think that. But you can do that when it comes to Europe and, you know, white, historically white regions. And the people, this is the dangerous part, have believed it. And they think it is their job to keep giving in and in and in and in, mm-hmm. even though they're this tiny minority. So it's beyond suicide.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, you know, and it's always a double standard. You know, every America, the West needs to be cosmopolitan and open in its society. Everywhere else is allowed to be insular and particular mm-hmm. in their society. And you know, they always tell us anything that's suggested to, you know, with immigration, whatever, to fix this, it's impossible. We don't have the will and the ability. And then you look at somewhere like Egypt, they're worried about potential immigration from nearby conflicts, and they erect like a fourfold wall overnight. So clearly it can be done. Yeah. I mean, Egypt is a much superior or inferior nation in this sense than America is supposed to be, but we just can't handle it. You know, so it's not only it is suicide, but it's preceding it as this kind of propagandistic demoralization, I think, is what everyone just feels. And that's why you know, books like this are a breath of fresh air to some people. They're like, oh, it's okay to not only have pride in your heritage, but to act like this. You know, here's examples to emulate. There's a reason the statues of our own founders are torn down. You know, don't emulate George Washington. That could be dangerous to be a man, you know, of conviction and power. So I think it's a really, I mean, I consider this book a great service. It was enjoyable for the audience who hasn't read it. It's very readable history. You know, some people have aversions to history. I love history through biography because, you know, a lot of what you're talking about with the discipline in academia, you know, a lot of it's skewed for this drive for a consumable narrative. They need a narrative so things are going to be smoothed over. When you tell the stories of men like this, you can accomplish all that without, you know, corrupting it, I think, in a unique way. And so this is a very good way for people who don't usually read history to get into it. And it's a quick read, even though it's long. But Terry, are you back with us? I know you dropped off for a bit. If you have any parting thoughts, we're coming up on the hour here and need to start closing it down.
Yeah, sorry, I was having some technical difficulties there.
No worries.
I am back. Yeah. And I just as by way of encouragement to Raymond, I just wanted to say we've got a reading discussion group and we're going through Defenders of the West as a group. And a couple of the guys in there are educators. One of them specifically is a educator in medieval history at a classical Christian school. And we constantly are, you know, one of the repeated refrains is just, how am I just hearing about this? How am I just now finding out about the truth behind the Crusades and about the specific individuals? And he's not reading the book with the class, but he's incorporating the lessons from the book into his class because they do cover the Crusades, and it's completely renovated his teaching on that subject. So it's making some small impact here, and hopefully that continues to grow and expand. But, you know, I would just offer that to you as a way of just a small kernel of encouragement that your work has been very, very helpful to us. It's enjoyable to us, but it's also making us think deep thoughts about, you know, what can we do to going forward to help further this goal.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I'm glad to hear that. And I've been told that by other people. And like you say, that is one of the big refrains. You know, why didn't I know this? And it especially comes from people who, you know, do have a background in history and have studied, because they've been, you know, this is one of the dangers of studying history in today's environment. You're almost better off not studying it at all and knowing you're ignorant, because then you know, I don't know. But if you go and you study and you get a PhD, then you think you know, but you actually oftentimes know the opposite of what really happened. But it makes you more stubborn in your belief, which is often wrong, unfortunately. At least in these particular cases, I'm not saying all of history, but where, you know, where there's a political element that can be used by certain elements of today, then yeah, it's going to be compromised. But thanks for sharing that. Yeah, it is encouraging.
Yep.
Well, that's a good word to end on. We're coming up on time. Raymond, thanks so much for sharing your time with us. Everyone go out and grab your copy of Defenders of the West. And I've heard the same thing, like all these reading groups of guys doing it, which is cool. I haven't heard that from another contemporary book. I've been involved in reading groups doing, you know, classics or whatever, just to become more educated. But for a new book to kind of make that impact, at least in our circles, is fascinating and great. Raymond, anything you want to share about people following? We talked about your potentially forthcoming works early, but anything else you want to direct people to about your own work and, you know, recent appearances, whatever you want to add?
Yeah. Anyone who's interested in, you know, following me or seeing what I do or write, I write a lot of articles every week and I do other videos. You can just go to my website, raymondibrahim.com, RaymondIbrahim.com. And it has links to all my books as well. And, information and contact if you want to contact me, there's a contact tab. But yeah, it's all there for whoever is interested.
Excellent. Well, again, thanks so much. And thank you, audience, for listening. Subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss our interviews with interesting guests like Raymond. And of course, you know, subscribe to the website. Again, Terry's review of Raymond's most recent book is there. And we have another one coming out of Sword and the Scimitar from Santiago Pelago. So look for that soon as well. Until next time, God bless. We'll be right back.
You can find American Reformer on the internet at www.americanreformer.org or on x.com, formerly Twitter, at AM Reformer. Don't forget to like, rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. Please consider supporting us today by making a tax-deductible donation through our secure online donation portal at AmericanReformer.org. That's AmericanReformer.org.